You're listening to Making Waves, Fresh Ideas in Freshwater Science. Making Waves is a bi-monthly podcast where we discuss new ideas in freshwater science and why they matter to you. Making Waves is brought to you with support by the Society for Freshwater Science, Arizona State University's School of Life Sciences, and the University of Washington School of Aquatic and Fisheries Sciences.
Welcome to the Making Waves podcast, brought to you by the Society for Freshwater Science. I'm your host, Stephen Elser. This month, we're joined by Stephen Cook, who's a PhD candidate in the Department of Biology at Baylor University. Thanks for joining us, Stephen.
I appreciate it. It's good to talk to you, Stephen.
So first, we're going to just start things off with an easy question. How are Chip and Joanna doing?
I got to tell you, that's a it's really weird for local Wacoans that Waco has become a tourist trap, as it were, since the fixer-upper explosion of popularity. So I think they're doing great. Magnolia Market's a fantastic resource for downtown Waco. So yeah, I think they're doing really well.
Okay, great. I'm happy to hear it. Okay, so you're a PhD candidate at Baylor. So can you tell us a little bit about your general research interests?
I am a freshwater stream ecologist, and I took kind of an odd path to academic research. I was not interested in ecology when I first learned, when I first read a book about it and first took a class on it. And then kind of on a whim, took a class on aquatic biology that primarily dealt with benthic macroinvertebrates or aquatic insects primarily, and was blown away by the amount of diversity in life and how interesting it was, you know, just underneath the water's surface. And I've kind of been enthralled with that from that point on. So most of my research kind of centers around the stream community, primarily how macroinvertebrates are responding to certain anthropogenic stressors. So my research kind of sits at the center of, you know, biodiversity research, but also introducing some, you know, temporal components and seasonal successional patterns and how biodiversity is affected by anthropogenic stressors.
Wow, great. So you say that you're a big fan of aquatic insects. Do you have a favorite taxa?
Gosh, that's a really good question. Yeah, I think a caddisfly, Marilia, I think might be my favorite taxa, just because, it can get some like beautiful head patterns. It's just a really interesting taxa. So yeah, I think probably that.
All right. Good choice. All right, great. So you recently published a paper entitled "Freshwater Eutrophication Drives Sharp Reductions in Temporal Beta Diversity." Can you tell us a little bit about this paper, what your general goals were, and then what you found?
Sure, absolutely. So that paper, I think it's important to mention up front, that paper grew out of a much larger study that was being conducted by my advisor, Dr. Ryan King, in the Illinois River in Oklahoma and Arkansas. So this is the Illinois River in Oklahoma and Arkansas, not the Illinois River in Illinois, which is, you know, a source of confusion when I, you know, try to tell my family about what I do. And the watershed that houses the Illinois River is special in a few different ways. And one of them is that it spans a pretty wide gradient of nutrient enrichment. There are some really pristine streams with, you know, very minimal human influence. And there are some streams in that area that they're quite enriched and have elevated phosphorus concentrations due to human activities and everything in between. And Ryan was tasked with determining at what point or what concentration elevated phosphorus caused a shift in the algal species composition or algal biomass. And I was one of the graduate students assisting with that project. And this paper came out of that. So the larger study was a really fantastic opportunity for graduate students, you know, like myself, to leverage that larger data set to answer questions of my own that I was interested in, because the Illinois River watershed is really uniquely suited for conducting natural experiments to answer questions about how eutrophication is influencing freshwater communities. And we've kind of already, you know, alluded to it, but I love benthic macroinvertebrates. I think they're a really important part of the stream ecosystem, and really interesting critters to study. So this paper, grew out of the SRJS study, the Scenic Rivers, joint phosphorus study. And this paper grew out of that. And it primarily answers the question about how the benthic macroinvertebrate communities are being affected temporally by phosphorus enrichment. And there's only one thing that you need to know to, you know, for listeners that don't, you know, study benthic macroinvertebrates and don't know a lot about them, there's really only one thing that you need to know to understand the study. And that is, under natural conditions, benthic macroinvertebrates are really seasonally variable. And a lot of these critters are specialized to make a living and be effective competitors at certain times of the year. And the paper in Ecology, demonstrates and outlines how, when you increase total phosphorus concentrations, you get declines in the amount of natural seasonal variation present in these macroinvertebrate communities. So you get more homogeneous communities, or communities that are more similar in time as phosphorus concentrations increase, which is a really cool finding, and one that I wasn't necessarily expecting. Because I was originally thinking of this study system kind of as a spatial question and not necessarily a temporal one. So it was kind of neat to see that.
Yeah, great. Thank you. So you mentioned eutrophication as one of the aspects that you were studying here. Can you talk a little bit about eutrophication? Just can you define it for us? What is eutrophication?
Sure. So eutrophication, you know, at its core is basically just what happens when too many nutrients get into a system. So aquatic systems fall on a continuum of productivity, and the level of nutrients available to organisms for growth is one of the primary controls on that productivity. And when I say nutrients, I'm talking about like the big two. I'm talking about nitrogen and phosphorus. And on one end of the spectrum, we have systems where nutrients are pretty scarce. So these are the really pristine streams in the Illinois River drainage basin. And these are called oligotrophic systems. And on the other end of the spectrum, we have systems where nutrients are much, much higher. And these are called eutrophic or hyper-eutrophic systems. So eutrophication is when the levels of nutrients in the water, you know, get to this higher level that they're too high, and they elicit really large increases in productivity.
Awesome. Thank you. So you also mentioned, right in the title of your paper, you mentioned temporal beta diversity. And you talk a little bit about, you sort of defined it earlier on, but could you more explicitly tell us what exactly is beta diversity?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and one that's been kind of hashed out in the literature in recent years. Beta diversity, like as a whole, has kind of become this umbrella term to encompass a bunch of different things and cover a bunch of different nuance. And beta diversity can mean a bunch of different things to different people, depending on, you know, the type of question that you're trying to tackle. But at its core, beta diversity just describes the amount of variation community to community, or assemblage to assemblage. So you have, you know, spot measurements of diversity. Let's just take it at its simplest level, just species richness. You can have a spot level of species richness at a particular place at a particular time, and that's called alpha diversity. But that only gives you information about one particular site. What is a lot more valuable is comparing two different sites. And beta diversity captures the dissimilarity or the uniqueness of those two different assemblages or communities from each other. So high values of beta diversity indicate very different, unique assemblages, and low values of beta diversity indicate more homogeneous communities. So they're very similar. And in our study, temporal beta diversity was a really good way of quantifying assemblage variation through time. So how different is a site or a community, you know, from itself at different time slices throughout a study? And that's what the question that I was very interested in, because naturally benthic macroinvertebrates display quite a bit of seasonally driven variation in assemblage structure. So any changes to that could highlight losses in biodiversity that you wouldn't necessarily detect just by taking spot measurements of diversity or solely looking at alpha diversity.
Thank you. That was an excellent explanation. So we keep talking about it, diversity in these streams. But why is it important that there is a highly biodiverse community of invertebrates in streams?
Benthic macroinvertebrates occupy a pretty important place in the stream ecosystem, kind of taking the big picture view. They're basically just little organic matter processing machines, and they occupy one of the key links between basal resources in the stream and higher trophic levels. So when some stressor is causing shifts in how these primarily insects are structured, the effects don't just stay compartmentalized to that little group of organisms. And it's pretty well established at this point that biodiversity and ecosystem functions are linked, and that when biodiversity declines, that's going to impact other processes going on in the stream, such as nutrient uptake and cycling, detrital processing, energy transfers, you know, up the food web. So biodiversity is important just on its by itself from that perspective. But as a scientist, they're an absolutely fantastic group of study organisms, because within the macroinvertebrate group or the macroinvertebrate assemblage, there's a huge diversity even within that assemblage in the way that they feed and what types of materials they consume, what habitats they prefer, what time of the year that they're active, and how they interact with each other. So it really makes them ideal when you're asking questions about how anthropogenic stressors are, you know, impacting biodiversity. It's a great group of organisms to look at.
Great, thank you. So finally, as we were talking about your paper, could you summarize your paper in the form of a haiku?
oh goodness. Okay, so, inverts partition time, add a little phosphorus, the partitions go away.
Good enough. That's excellent. Thank you very much.
Good enough. That was great.
Beautiful improvised haiku.
That's pretty bad.
Very impressed. Okay, great. So you mentioned that your work in this paper was a part of a larger project called the Scenic River Joint Phosphorus Study. Could you tell us a little bit about that? What's the history of the project and how it came to be?
Absolutely. And this is a really interesting part of the story. And it's going to take a little bit of a history lesson and a little bit of a law lesson. And I'm definitely not a lawyer, so bear with me. But the Scenic Rivers Joint Phosphorus Study was put together by the Scenic Rivers Joint Study Commission. And its objective was to determine at what level of phosphorus enrichment do any statistically significant shifts in algal species composition or algal biomass occur that in turn result in undesirable aesthetic conditions in the designated scenic rivers. And that's a mouthful. I totally understand that's a mouthful, but it's important because Oklahoma has designated scenic rivers. And to kind of understand that, you need to understand a little bit about the structure of the watershed. So I mentioned that this was a river that spanned the border between Arkansas and Oklahoma. So the headwaters of this watershed originate in Arkansas. They flow across the border into Oklahoma. And once they do that, a lot of these waterways are Oklahoma designated scenic rivers, which affords them special protection under state statute. another piece of this puzzle that you need to understand is that there are two main sources of phosphorus in this watershed. Northwest Arkansas houses, I think second only to Georgia, the largest density of poultry production in the United States. And where you have lots of chickens, you have lots of chicken poop. And it makes a really cheap fertilizer for people to spread on their fields and their pastures. But it's also very high in phosphorus, runs off, gets into the waterways, and that's one source of, you know, phosphorus loading to these systems. The other source of phosphorus in the Illinois River watershed is Arkansas. Northwest Arkansas is experiencing a pretty large population boom. You got three big cities up there. You've got Springdale, Rogers, Fayetteville, and where you have a lot of people, you need wastewater treatment plants. That's just kind of how it goes. And it just so happens that historically, quite a few of the wastewater treatment plants are placed on, you know, waterways like they normally are. But sometimes they've been very close to the border between Arkansas and Oklahoma, sometimes almost comically close to the border of Arkansas and Oklahoma. And that's not, you know, from any malice on, you know, Arkansas's part. That's just, you know, where the population centers are located. So that's two big sources or big potential sources of phosphorus in this watershed. And all the way back to the 1970s, they started noticing algae blooms both in the Illinois River and in Lake Tenkiller, which is what the Illinois empties into. And Oklahoma didn't appreciate this. And this culminated in a Supreme Court decision. There was lots of litigation back and forth between Oklahoma and Arkansas. And this culminated in a Supreme Court decision in 1992, where Oklahoma disagreed with the issuance of a permit, an EPA permit for a wastewater treatment plant facility that emptied into the Illinois River, and sued and brought suit. And that went all the way to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court decided that the permit would stand, like that was a valid permit. But the really important part of that Supreme Court decision is that it set the precedent that the EPA had wide latitude to interpret water quality standards and could take into account downstream water quality criteria in the issuances of their permits. So, and this was a big deal. Like it acknowledged the interconnectedness of waterways, and really acknowledged that. So, you know, if I have a stream going through my backyard, and it originates in your backyard, Stephen, what goes on or what you do in your backyard has a direct influence on me and the part of the water going through my backyard. So it was really an acknowledgement of that. And was really important for case law in the United States, because if they hadn't found that, water quality criteria in the United States would always be set by the lowest common denominator, and water always flows downhill. It's, you know, one of the big fixtures of life, you know, death taxes and water flows downhill. So it was a really important decision. And since that time, the two states have really been working together to reduce phosphorus loads. And this culminated in, it's called the Statement of Joint Principles. It's basically both states getting together and going, you know, like we need to stop the litigation back and forth. Let's both work together to reduce phosphorus loads to this watershed. You know, like we both care about the quality of the water, you know, both states do. And they got together and appointed a joint study committee. So this was three experts appointed by the governor of Oklahoma and three experts appointed by the governor of Arkansas. And these experts got together and appointed an out-of-state third party. And my advisor, Ryan King, put together a great study and was selected to conduct the study. And, you know, it was definitely to my benefit because I learned a lot from this and was able to collect some amazing data. So that's, I realize that's a pretty long history lesson, but it really has been going on, you know, since the 1970s, and has some really cool, you know, milestones along the way, and has culminated in this project.
Yeah. Thank you. That was an excellent history lesson. I think you did a really good job, introducing it. So you mentioned us in sort of like the mission statement of this project was to determine at what point elevated phosphorus concentrations resulted in undesirable aesthetic conditions brought in by algae blooms. So could you talk about what's so undesirable about these algae blooms? Can you talk just about what it looked like when these blooms occurred?
Yeah, absolutely. So the primary taxa of concern in these waterways is a nuisance green algae called Cladophora. It's a filamentous algae, and it can really, really explode and bloom and proliferate at high levels of total phosphorus, and it will absolutely carpet the bottom of stream beds, and you'll get these huge long streamers of Cladophora, sometimes feet and feet long, that completely transform, you know, even like the physical structure of the benthos when clad really takes off. And when it gets grazed down, like it gets, you know, like these very like thick mat, like these carpets of clad that, you know, look almost like shag carpet-ish. So the nuisance algae blooms can really, really result in some, you know, undesirable, you know, I might even border on kind of gross aesthetic qualities, and certainly affects life that's living in the stream, you know, and the benthic macrovertebrates, which are near and dear to my heart.
Yeah, right. And also, so I get, at this point, I'm going to say full disclosure, I was a technician on this project and worked alongside Mr. Cook here. And I remember, in addition to, yeah, obviously having this big impact on benthic invertebrates and it being really nasty looking, to speak more on that, like we would regularly see folks like floating down the river near, yeah, at some of our sampling locations. And like, I could very much, you know, see how these big blooms could negatively impact recreational ecosystem services that the streams provide.
Yeah, absolutely. Like this is like, I can't impress, you know, upon your listeners enough how gorgeous, beautiful of a watershed this is and how special this area of the country is. It's absolutely gorgeous. You know, and like, you know, Oklahoma designated these state scenic rivers for a reason. You know, they are a resource that is worthy of protection and preservation. So, you know, anything that negatively influences, you know, both wildlife conservation or outdoor recreational value, you know, is a concern. So it's, I was really, you know, glad that I could be a part of this project, you know, because I think, you know, two different entities or two different states, you know, getting together and saying, you know, this is something that we want to address and we're going to do it in a scientifically defensible manner. And we're going to listen to the recommendations that, you know, the team puts forth, you know, I think it's a really, you know, a special thing that hasn't really happened a lot, or at least to my knowledge, hasn't really happened a lot.
Yeah,
in the past.
I agree. That is something that was really special about this project. Can you talk a little bit more about that in terms of how it felt for you to be a graduate student working on a project that you knew would have you know, potential policy implications for the state?
Sure. Yeah, it was kind of a sobering experience, to be completely honest with you. You know, I've been involved in research in the past that, you know, has, you know, effect on me. But, you know, contributing to a project that is directly going to, you know, influence, you know, public policy and, you know, nutrient criteria, I was very conscious of that. And my advisor, Ryan King, you know, did a very good job of, you know, well, one, designing and implementing the study, but two, you know, involving his graduate students, you know, in this project, but also insulating us enough from, you know, the greater study, you know, enough that we could, you know, like concentrate on doing good science without necessarily having to worry about, you know, like stakeholder meetings and like standing up in front of those, you know, people. And so I think Ryan, you know, balanced those two needs very, very well. Like, hey, this is part of a larger project, but, you know, you also have the latitude to to go out, do good science, ask interesting questions. So I was really lucky in that regard.
Yeah. So you mentioned stakeholder meetings. Were there any other sort of outreach or communication efforts that the research team as a whole, or maybe Ryan more specifically, took part in as a part of this project?
Sure. You might have to have Ryan back on to get a really good detailed answer to that question. For my side of things, just talking to members of the community and you know, kind of being kind of injected into that situation, you know, at the beginning, you know, having some knowledge of it, but not really like having a gut understanding of how long these issues have been been discussed, you know, in that watershed. You know, everybody knows about these issues if you live in that watershed. So talking to people who live there, and landowners, you know, like, you know, streams, you know, go through land, and occasionally we would encounter landowners who were, you know, had a varying degree of curiosity about the project, but talking to them and seeing just how important water quality was and how important the streams and the rivers in this region were to them, like was a very good experience, was a very neat experience. And communicating, you know, what we were doing, why we were collecting this data, how the benthic macroinvertebrate community could, you know, tell us things about the stream ecosystem as a whole. Like that was a very good, you know, learning experience for me.
Yeah. So this seems like this was a very impactful and like large scale project. Did you encounter any like challenges along the way in field work or any notable events that were a challenge that you had to overcome?
Sure. I would say the one, you know, like the paper that we were discussing earlier, you know, was concerned with the benthic macroinvertebrate assemblage. I would say the first challenge is not really understanding how large of an undertaking that was going to be when I first started. So, you know, we had 35 sites, you know, in this watershed, and we sampled every other month for 2 years. And those HESS samples add up really quick. And I can't remember, like you had mentioned that you were a technician on the project and really, you know, integral to processing, you know, these samples. I don't know at what sampling event we got a little bit behind. But the first challenge was just getting through and counting and identifying these samples, in a timely manner. And I can't emphasize enough how much of a team effort that was. You know, I wasn't the only graduate student working on the project. Lauren Housley also worked on the invert samples. Catherine Hooker and Morgan Betcher were awesome technicians. And if we didn't have you guys, I would literally at this moment still be sitting in front of a microscope, picking and identifying benthic macroinvertebrates. So thank you so much. And that was kind of the first hurdle that we had to reach. And I can't think of any other like huge, you know, giant hurdles that we had to cross. And that's to, you know, all credit to Ryan for really designing and doing, you know, some amazing site selection to answer the questions that we were interested in. You know, everything kind of goes, you know, smooth. You know, everything is more smooth the more work that you do before the study actually starts. So, you know, credit to Ryan for that. We did have a large 500-year flood towards the end of the study, which really just completely moved some of the streams, like, you know, in their path. And, you know, this was, you know, kind of a unique experience for my career because it's the first time that I've gotten to go back and go to the same sites, you know, again and again and again, and see, you know, just how variable stream ecosystems are. So the 500-year flood was a, you know, a hurdle, but also a really good opportunity to see how these communities respond to, you know, semi-catastrophic scouring event, you know, and how, you know, the successional patterns afterwards.
Yeah, great. It really was cool revisiting those same sites again and again throughout the years, and seeing how during some sampling events the stream would be down to just a trickle, barely any water at all. And then 2 months later, it'd be huge. It'd be like 30 or 40 meters across and roaring. So I think that was a really cool part of the project, to see how much in flux that stream ecosystems really are.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of these, you know, since the paper we were talking, my paper, you know, deals with, you know, the temporal component, you know, any temporal change that we saw was a really interesting part of the story of that ecosystem for me. And these are, you know, most of these streams, have base flow year round. But you're right. Like, you know, the changes in hydrology, you know, season to season, and the changes in the community, I think are a really, you know, interesting and understudied part, of what's happening in these streams ecosystems.
Okay, great. That's all that I have for you right now. Is there anything else that you'd like to say about stream eutrophication and how it impacts macroinvertebrate diversity, or anything else about the project that you want people to know about?
No, I think those were excellent questions, and I really appreciated the opportunity to talk to you about it.
Yeah, anytime. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Stephen.
You've been listening to the Making Waves podcast, brought to you with support by the Society for Freshwater Science. For more information on this speaker, the Making Waves podcast, or the Society in general, please visit us on the web at the Society for Freshwater Science webpage. Tune in next time for another fresh idea in freshwater science.